I'm going to hoist this off to Aaron Hsu and Hope Roberts.
Awesome. Thank you so much, John. That was really fascinating. And I learned a lot, actually. I didn't realize that caribou and sitka deer were also imported to the region. Very interesting. Thank you. Appreciate the introduction. And I also want to say that Hope is a rock star as well. Hope is CERC's intertribal liaison under our Subsistence Alliance program. And so she does a lot of work kind of keeping up on hunting and fishing regulations and trying to, you know, educate the rest of us and educate our tribal members on what's happening with hunting and fishing and plant gathering and all of that. Thank you all for joining us tonight. When I first agreed to do this, I thought, you know, John had approached me and said, hey, we'd love to do this presentation. Can you talk about some of the terrestrial land mammals and hunting? And I said, sure. And then I finished the research that I was doing that I'm going to talk about and realized that I don't have a lot about land mammals, actually. Tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about the ocean as a part of me, climate change and subsistence in the Chugach region. So I'm going to cover both the land and the sea, and also talk a bit about some things we haven't discussed so far, such as marine mammals and shellfish. John mentioned I work for Chugach Regional Resources Commission. We are an intertribal natural resource management and economic nonprofit formed in 1984, and we serve the seven tribes of the Chugach region. Where our seven tribes are located, we've got Port Graham and Nanwalek that are down on the southern Kenai Peninsula, and Katuchik Native Tribe in Seward. We've got Chiniga, Tutitlik, Iyak, and Valdez Native Tribe in Valdez. And our mission, it is to promote tribal sovereignty and the protection of our subsistence lifestyle and to assure the conservation, sustainable economic development, and stewardship of the natural resources in the traditional use areas of the Chugach region. So before I dive into talking about this research that we did on climate vulnerability, I'd actually like to turn it over to Hope to talk a little bit more about our mission statement and what it means. And for her as a subsistence user, you know, how important this harvest is and what it means beyond just getting out and getting food.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Erin. I'm Hope Roberts. Everybody keeps mentioning subsistence and then they want to know how I, as an Alaska Native, feel about that. I tend to not like to use the word subsistence because cultural harvesting is different to me than what like the state definition of subsistence it means to like the rest of the state. In the health aspect, Erin is talking about in her slideshow, the active lifestyles that Alaskan Natives are accustomed to when it comes to hunting and fishing, it all ties into physical, spiritual, and mental health. And I only recently learned exactly what that means as a Tlingit Athabascan person, as I wasn't taught a lot of my Tlingit heritage, but my husband is a Nubek. So he also is comes from a marine mammal hunting family. So I learned how to harvest seals and sea otters through him. It's a different culture, but it's amazing and I love it. And the first time I took harvested a seal, that was the first time in the 35 years of my life that I knew exactly who I was and as an Alaska Native person. And it was super healing. And the connection to culture made me a lot more confident in who I am. And that's how I became an advocate for the hunting and fishing regulations for a lot of Alaska Natives. So I live in Valdez, Alaska. And this is the home of the Aleutic people and the Iyak people. And it doesn't matter where people are from. I just like to help people understand how the rules and regulations work for hunting and fishing, because when you harvest animals, there's so much connection to the culture. I never thought that I would be teaching my daughter firsthand at 4 years old. This was about 6 years ago on how to harvest marine mammals, but it was a super healing, connecting time for us as a family. That was a really fun weekend. I actually took both of those seals with one round while that boat was moving. It was a very exhilarating time in my life. For me as a Native person, Alaska Natives, whatever resource is given to them where they live, that is typically their soul food, you know, and it's really important for me to make sure that people in these regions that I represent know their rights. Because, you know, these animals that people harvest and eat in their particular region, it's what's healthy to them. It's what keeps them out of, you know, the obesity and not having diabetes is that they can eat the food that their bodies are accustomed to. Pretty much what cultural harvesting is to me. So yeah, thanks, Erin. I hope that was clear.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Hope. I just love that you shared this with us because, you know, as Hope is talking about, subsistence is more than a legal classification. It is a way of life and you know, it is indigenous cultural harvest. There's a lot more than just nutritious food, which is also very important, but a lot more than just nutritious food to subsistence harvest. I also wanted to give a quick overview of our climate change program. In 2015, we completed phase one, which was kind of a survey of the landscape, what's out there as far as funding opportunities and technologies and adaptation techniques, things like that. Currently in phase two, where we are working to develop a vulnerability assessment of cultural resources, and so or cultural subsistence resources. And so what I'll share with you tonight is some of the preliminary results. And I just want to just stress that it's preliminary because I have not had a chance to vet this with the tribes that we work with and make sure that it's accurate. So it could change after we have an opportunity to do that. And then early next year, once this vulnerability assessment wraps up, we'll be moving on to developing climate adaptation plans and monitoring plans, health monitoring plans that in phase three, and we'll build on the results of this vulnerability assessment to help create a regional plan for adaptation and climate preparation. I wanted to throw just a tiny bit of theory at you really quickly, looking at this connection between climate and human health, because that's what we're really, that connection that we're trying to make with this work. So we've heard a lot from John, and we heard last week, for those of you who were able to attend, about some of the climate drivers, and also not climate drivers, but the things that are creating environmental change, which can lead in some cases to environmental hazards. People, you know, are exposed to this through exposure pathways, which might already exist or might form as environments change. These can create health impacts that can lead to disparate health outcomes, depending on people's sensitivity, or depending on how vulnerable people and resources are to these changes. I'm talking about a vulnerability assessment. I do want to say that I don't like that word very much, because it kind of implies a sense of helplessness. And I don't think that's the case at all. What we're talking about when we talk about vulnerability is the potential that to suffer negative health outcomes as a result of a changing environment. So exposure to environmental hazards and sensitivity to those hazards combine to create conditions of vulnerability. And conversely, we have adaptive capacity, which is the skills and knowledge and tools that people have or can develop to respond to those changes and reduce sensitivity or reduce exposure. So vulnerability is also complex. We've talked a lot about how the physical environment can create vulnerability, but there's also socioeconomic aspects to it as well. And I think that's where subsistence is something that can be challenging to look at. You know, cultural harvest, and I apologize to Hope, I slip up and call it subsistence a lot because I'm a former Alaska Department of Fish and Gamer. So, you know, I think of it in that term, but I think it's really important the point that she makes of the difference there. So cultural harvest can create exposure pathways. You know, people are out there, like John was talking about, there could be emerging diseases in wildlife, fish and wildlife, that could impact human health. There's also, you know, social exposure pathways, such as poverty, different occupations might put you more in harm's way. Racial discrimination can create exposure to these hazards. There's a lot of different factors that feature in. The thing with cultural harvest is that it also is a coping mechanism. It helps contribute to adaptive capacity. You heard from Hope about, you know, how healing subsistence was and being able to have that connection to culture and also that connection, you know, to her children. And that sense of community is really important. There is evidence that participating in subsistence activities can help reduce underlying health disparities, such as reducing obesity and reducing the incidence of diabetes. So there's a lot of good that comes from cultural harvest, even though it does create an exposure pathway to potential environmental hazards. So this is a poster that CERC commissioned about 2 years ago that shows some of the most important wild foods in this region. And there's a couple of points that I wanted to make about this. First is there's a lot of ocean in here because ocean is really important. And a lot of times, at least, you know, in Western management, we tend to think on a species by species basis. And as you'll see, as I kind of go through the results, we do talk about species individually, or I do talk about that. But I've gotten a lot of feedback from tribes when we do this work that, you know, there's a lot of cascading effects and everything is connected. And so it's important to also think about those connections and the place that resources have in an ecosystem. I also just wanted to really quickly mention the Exxon Valdez oil spill, just because as I go through some historical harvest data, this shows up. I'm going to talk about two communities today. The first one is Chinica, which is on Chinica Island. You can see my cursor there. And the other one is Port Graham, which is down here on the southern Kenai Peninsula. And then this black area that you see, this is from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council report. This black plume is where oil went after the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. So you can see that Chinica was just absolutely surrounded by oil, and that Port Graham came out a little bit better, but still was heavily impacted by this oil spill. And I just bring that up because you'll definitely see this impact in some of the historical subsistence data. So the first community that I wanted to talk about is the native village of Chinica. Chinica was actually originally located on an island that was a little bit north of here called Evans Island. The original town site, unfortunately, was destroyed in the 1964 earthquake, and a number of people in the community were killed. About 20 years later, you know, those people, the survivors scattered to Cordova, to Titlick, and Anchorage, and about 20 years later, in 1984, resettled at the modern-day Chinica. Chinica's population is about 80 people, and it's about 60 to 70% Alaska Native. So this is from Alaska Department of Fish and Game data, and it just looks at historical harvests in years that they did a comprehensive harvest survey. So we have a couple of pre-spill years that we can see. You know, this is total overall harvest in pounds. So 1984, about 18,000 pounds of wild foods were harvested. 1985, 22,000 by the whole community. Then I list the top five species that were harvested each year. So in 84, we've got harbor seal, deer, stellar sea lion, coho salmon or silver salmon, and halibut. And pretty similar looking distribution in 1985. And then those numbers on the right are the pounds of each of those species that were harvested. Then we hit the spill years. And like I said, you can really see it here in Chinica, significantly depressed harvests, and also a change in what people are harvesting. We've got, you know, a more greater emphasis on fish and less, you know, you don't even see marine mammals up there. You know, a lot of concerns about contamination and the health of the resources during that time. And also the populations in some cases weren't doing well. We see recovery in 1997, 33,000 pounds of wild food harvested. You know, we see kind of the shift during this time too, that again, seals and sea lions aren't actually on that top five species list. So the deer, halibut, and salmon are very important during these years. 2003, we have seal back up on here. There's actually six species. I'm not sure why they separated out saltwater and harbor seal, so I kept those separate. And then looking at 2014 is the most recent comprehensive survey year that they have. You see, you know, there's a lot less total harvest that year, but by 2014, the population was also a lot smaller than it was earlier. So I didn't look at per capita harvest in this, but, you know, you can definitely see some trends there. And again, you also see that shift. In 2014, we don't see as much, we don't see marine mammals in the top five. And for the first time, we see moose, which is really interesting. This graph shows the results of the vulnerability assessment that we were doing for Chinica. So we asked people to rate species that they used on two scales. So down here on the horizontal axis, we have perceived risk to that species from climate change by subsistence users. And it goes from low to high. Basically, we gave people post-it notes that were green for low risk, yellow for high risk, and yellow for medium risk and red for high risk, and asked them to label these species. So I translated that to one for low risk, two for medium risk, three for high risk. On the vertical axis, we see the perceived impact on well-being from changes in availability of subsistence of that resource. What this means, essentially, we ask people on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being no noticeable impact and 10 being a life-altering impact, like you would maybe need to change jobs or would need to move away from your community, how much would changes in this species affect your life and your daily life? So we can see, for example, up here in the upper right-hand corner, we've got herring roe, we've got seals, we've got sea lions, we've got marine mammals. These are species that people thought were at high risk from climate change and also were really important to them as wild foods and for that spiritual and for that connection. We see pink and silver salmon over here. King salmon and sockeye salmon were considered low risk, but very important species. You can also see, you know, grouse and fiddlehead ferns were considered both low risk and also not super impactful if people were not able to harvest those for some reason. So what were people saying about some of these theses? We also collected some qualitative data in addition to this more quantitative data. So a couple of general observations that people had in Chiniga were that they were seeing a lot more warmer water and less water overall. One thing that they noted is that coastal erosion is happening, especially with big storms. And there's a lot of concern that that could release trapped oil that's still there from the oil spill 30 years ago. And John did a great job of kind of talking about some of these compounding challenges when it comes to climate change. You know, and here's an example of how that can happen. You know, you have climate change creating one environmental hazard, coastal erosion, that could potentially be exacerbated by the release of oil trapped in a subsurface area. And also just a general observation that they were seeing plants, especially alders, grow at higher elevations than in the past, showing kind of that moving up of the tree line as the climate warms. For salmon, some observations that people had included that there was a changing outmigration of smolts. They noted that traditionally smolts, for king salmon specifically, would outmigrate in the rivers in April, and now they've been seeing it happening much sooner. There's a lot of concern there that the food sources that salmon need when they get to where they're going won't be there, and that they'll go hungry. They also noted increased pre-spawn mortality. Somebody said that they just saw a lot of salmon floating dead in the streams around Chiniga, looking like they'd been baked, especially in 2019. And again, spawning in unusual places. So residents of Chiniga described the beaches being pink with salmon eggs in 2019 because the rivers were too low for the salmon to get up. And I think that was related to pink salmon, if I am remembering that correctly. So, you know, a lot of changes that we're not quite sure what those impacts will be, but people are definitely noticing changes. Halibut, you know, the changes that people described, I think are similar to things that we've heard about before. They're generally smaller. You know, halibut are being found in different spots than where they used to be found. And also there's different timing. You know, residents in Chiniga noted that you used to be able to catch them in January and you just can't anymore. People noticed we're no longer entering Prince William Sound and talked about how moose used to come from Seward and come around into Prince William Sound and no longer do it. There's a lot of concern. Moose, you know, Chiniga actually relies on moose. They mentioned that it was one of the most important resources for them, and they're concerned about not being able to harvest them in the future. Seals, there was a lot of concern about, as glaciers melt, losing some of the ice flows that they use as pupping habitat and what that could do for seal populations in the future. In contrast, I wanted to talk about the community of Port Graham, which is down here on the southern Kenai Peninsula. This is also a community that is off the road system. You have to take a ferry or a plane to get there. Okay, it was first settled in the late 1800s. And commercial fishing is the primary source of income. There's also logging, construction, and healthcare. The population is about 180 people, and it's about 80% Alaska Native. Here's a look at that overall subsistence harvest. Again, this is total pounds of food harvested by the community in years that there is a comprehensive survey done. You notice this is a higher population, so higher amounts of food. Again, I didn't do this on a per capita basis. So we have one year that is pre-spill, 1987, and you can see that halibut is the most important subsistence species, followed by different types of salmon. I mentioned that, we can see the oil spill here in 1989. Port Graham was not as impacted by it as Chiniga was immediately in their surrounding area. So we also see a faster recovery from the subsistence numbers. But we definitely see, a little bit in 1992 and 1993, some different species of freshwater fish, some trout here, species coming into play and being harvested pretty significantly. So here's the data about some of the remaining years. Again, really, really similar. There's been a lot of consistency in fish being a really important species in Port Graham. Just to kind of highlight that, this is the harvest in Port Graham by general category. So this darker green that you can see is salmon. The lighter green is non-salmon fish. And then all those smaller brown and orange boxes are everything else. So fish are really important in Port Graham. A couple of observations that came from Port Graham observations. People talked about it being drier and warmer in the summer, especially 2019. They actually ran out, their well went dry in 2019, or their water supply went dry. And also milder, shorter winters that they feel have really impacted winter species in the area. They noted lots of green algae growth in streams that they worried had negative impacts on salmon and more frequent red tides. Port Graham talked a lot about the loss of opportunity for cultural gatherings around wild foods and how much that impacted their ability to connect with their community and raise youth the way that they wanted to raise their youth. So a couple of specifics about species, people in Port Graham described changing diets. They said that especially in king salmon, they've been noticing that stomach contents have been changing and also just changing runs. So the people in Port Graham talked about how several years ago, kings stopped running into their nets, their set nets set close to shore. Now they're starting to notice that with sockeye salmon. And so they're concerned that sockeye might be going the way of the kings. Halibut are smaller and there's fewer of them. Mountain goats, they actually noted, people in Port Graham noted that moose were important, but they didn't really have many comments about them. So I included a comment about mountain goats, which are not targeted as often, but are also really appreciated in Port Graham. They noticed that a lot of the mountain goats in the region are using different migration routes and seem to be altering that pattern. And looking at seals, they observed that they've been noticing that seals are a lot thinner. You know, many people said that they felt the populations of seals were stable, but that there had also been changes, maybe some changes in the last 5 to 7 years. So that's just a quick overview of, like I said, the preliminary results from this research. So our next steps are to finalize this vulnerability assessment and then move on to that phase 3, where we're going to be doing two things primarily. One is identifying indicators of community health to monitor and developing plans for how to monitor those. And we've already started to do that a little bit with our shellfish hatchery that we operate out of Seward. The Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery has been doing ongoing ocean acidification monitoring for quite a while. We've also recently got a grant to start paralytic shellfish poisoning testing for the South Central region. And so we'll be able to let people know, you know, if samples that are submitted contain PSP toxins. And then we plan to actually move that into a harmful algal bloom monitoring laboratory the following year. And we also want to work to identify partners to help advance climate resilience in the region because, you know, we all live in this place, and I think we all want to protect it. And so there's a lot of opportunities to find synergy between what we're doing, with our tribes and what's happening elsewhere. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Erin and John and Hope.
That's moderator Dave Acheson from the Kenai Peninsula College Showcase Series. This discussion was recorded on December 9th, and you just heard Erin Hsu and Hope Roberts give their presentation, The Ocean is Part of Me, Imak Ilim, Climate Change and Subsistence in the Chugach Region. The first presentation was called Climate Effects on Moose, Caribou, and Sitka Black-tailed Deer on the Kenai Peninsula and Prince William Sound. That was Dr. John Morton. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. You can hear this discussion by going to kbbi.org and searching Kenai Peninsula College Showcase Series. Thanks for listening, Kachemak Bay. This has been The Coffee Table, and you are tuned to KBBI Homer, AM 890. Good morning.